So, Ezra.
Hey, Ray.
Why are we here?
Excellent question, Ray. Well, we would not be here today or on this podcast if it wasn't for our guest today, Lily Tsai, our colleague from political science, our dear colleague from political science. So not only is Lily an insightful scholar of Chinese and African politics, she's also the founder and faculty director of the MIT Governance Lab, a group of political scientists who work collaboratively with practitioners on research and innovation in citizen engagement and government accountability. And we'll hear a bit of that.
She's going to bring her insights on civic engagement to helping us understand, like, what type of community would we want to create at MIT that might be able to help with some of our current challenges?
Yep.
You know, to say more about, you know, the official introduction of Lily. Mm-hmm. You know, Lily is also the immediate past chair of the MIT faculty. As well, we'll see, she is very thoughtful in what it means to be a leader in our community.
So Lily, who I've got the great pleasure to know for several years leading up to October 7th in the crisis that unfolded from there, and we've talked about as the prompt for this podcast. You know, the word podcast first came out of your mouth, so it was great that we had that relationship in place already at that point, but I think it's become deepened even since then in ways that we really value.
Ezra, can I add in though? Lily,
please.
I think it's important for you to hear that I wouldn't have said yes if Ezra hadn't told me that this was something you were thinking about doing.
Our conspiracy, Lily and mine, to get Ray in. Yeah, says a lot about how much we respect and cherish Lily as a colleague.
In all seriousness, I've so appreciated the podcast because the two of you are really being very transparent about learning and grappling with things in real time. And I think that is the big advantage over a webinar, where it always feels like people are talking at you or like downloading information. So, you know, it's actually made me think a lot about something that the novelist Marilynne Robinson says about grace. She's a novelist, but she comes from a pretty religious background, I think it's fair to say. And she talks about how grace is not forgiveness for an offense, but instead it's saying or understanding, once you understand, that there was no offense in the first place. And I think that a lot of what the two of you have been doing is showing us that if we can understand the lenses that people have, you know, maybe we can offer some grace, that we can find a way to realize or to think that there was no offense in the first place. So I'm very grateful for the two of you and all of the work that you've been doing on this podcast.
Thank you, Lily. I mean, I'll say back, I mean, I do want to caution, I think there, as we've been saying, there is animus out there. There is bigotry. There are offenses. People are not wrong that such offenses have occurred and are ongoing. But if we're, you know, that's not the whole story. It's a difficult, challenging situation, and people aren't aware of what people are feeling, experiencing, don't know the best way to reach out. And that can create, as we start talking about in the first episode, people drawing reasonable, but maybe somewhat off inferences that there was an offense, like you're saying, from especially people who actually care about them, and hopefully an institution that actually cares about them.
Giving people the benefit of the doubt is important, but because I'm so glad you weren't saying, you know, I can think of a lot of words I would use to describe myself and to describe Ezra. Grace.
You mean graceful? Yeah.
Well, grace comes in all forms, but I think that Ezra, what you're saying is also important to acknowledge. Absolutely.
And so, you know, Lily, you've been listening to different episodes of the podcast, and you know, you had a really interesting reaction to churches and validation, where this whole idea that churches, and it's difficult to bring people who are different together in churches because they're there to validate religious identity, where universities have a greater capacity for that. And this made you think about some interesting work that one of your students that was doing. And so I thought that might be a good place to start.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, I thought that the conversation you were having in a previous episode about how important churches are for validating one's religious identity and membership in a religious community was really interesting. I have a former student, Jasmine English, who's done some incredible research on Boston area churches, both racially diverse ones as well as homogenous ones. And Jasmine finds that despite the fact that racially diverse churches might have the, you might think that it had, they have the most potential to create cross-cutting connections and mobilize around, say, racial justice. What Jasmine actually finds is that those racially diverse churches face what she calls dilemmas of accommodation. And that what winds up happening is that they develop norms of conflict avoidance. So rather than becoming more politicized, say, around racial justice, they actually wind up being some of the least politically active. And that made me, you know, really think about what that means for the university. Because the university is, of course, a very pluralist, diverse community. And it doesn't necessarily have the ability to conceptualize itself as a sanctuary for, say, conflict avoidance.
So it's funny. It's interesting. So here's this idea of a church, and it turns out these racially diverse churches, in them, you can't bring your whole self to church. You know, you've got to edit yourself. It's a, you have to accommodate in order to maintain this relationship with someone who's different, although you share this faith. I think that's very interesting, at least from my perspective.
Can we, I want to see if I understand that and unpack that a little bit. You know, Ray and I painted this image in the last episode, of, or episode three, of how difficult it is to have an interracial church because of established ritual that maybe just happens to be historically correlated with race, even if that's enough to produce kind of a very strong conservatism.
But we were talking about a kind of avoidance that would happen where they wouldn't even join the same church.
That's right.
Lily's talking about, okay, they made the decision. They
took the step.
They joined the same church, and yet still.
Right. And so we would think those people who are making an extra effort to overcome that would be then particularly able to like work together on dealing. And they'd be the kind of people who want to work on issues of social justice and racial justice in particular. But you're saying there's a dilemma of, what was it again, Lily, of accommodation?
Yeah, Jasmine calls it the dilemmas of accommodation. That, you know,
what is the problem with, if so, I'm picturing like somehow they are involved, but just not through the church, and or some of them at least are involved in, say, racial justice efforts, but they're somehow reluctant to bring that into the church among people who you would think would be allies.
Yeah.
Right. And so what does Jasmine say is the kind of nature of that? What's the dilemma? So, like, can you not do that?
So, I mean, I think that her argument is that what winds up happening is that racially diverse churches wind up conceiving of themselves as sanctuaries where, you know, you get a break from that kind of conflict and those difficult conversations.
Like a political sanctuary, in a sense.
We're going to be neutral.
Right.
Because yeah. I think if you start talking about racial justice, it requires that I, at least some of the time, consider my own privilege. And that's, you know, I found that's a very hard thing for people to do. Hmm. Right? Because if I want to talk about how someone else is disadvantaged, it's usually helpful if I'm willing to also talk about the advantages that I have. And it's been my experience, those conversations don't go so well.
Yeah. So that made me think a lot about universities can't really conceive of themselves as sanctuaries where we just decide collectively never to talk about difference. And I've been doing a lot of thinking about the kind of civic infrastructure that we need to recreate, reinvent in order to have and celebrate and enjoy differences and pluralism. And here, you know, our colleague Bernardo Zacca, who's a political philosopher, has made the case for what he calls in-between spaces where people have, you know, Bernardo argues that in order for us to be able to enjoy the diversity and pluralism that exists in our communities and in society, each of us has to have some control over how close or far we are from, you know, all of the blooming, buzzing confusion and excitement that is kind of on the street. So I've been thinking a lot about the kinds of ways in which we would be able to give people that control. Can we each have some agency over how much we want to get involved in these kinds of difficult political conversations? And can we give everybody the ability to also step back and reflect and be in a protected environment where they can have their head down, analyze data, do their work? Yeah.
And you're saying, Lily, that there's good reason to think that it's a healthy thing to be able to kind of like just have the ability to bleed into the background, not have your primary identity be more salient, but when you're at work or at school, to have that, you know, turned off at some level, right?
I mean, I think, you know, one thing I've been thinking a lot about as I work on thinking about how to design digital spaces that enable people to have this kind of control over how close or how far they are from the difficult conversations is indeed the fact that, you know, people kind of have it in a black and white way, right? Like when you're online, you're just in it. There's a lot of noise and it's very loud and it's very hot. And there's no way to step back and have cooler, slower conversations because of the way social media is designed. What I've heard, you know, I remember talking to a student coming out of one of these Dialogues of Differences talks that the Institute held, and I had moderated one of them, and I was asking this student, what do you do when you and your classmates disagree really heatedly about something? And, you know, they said to me, we don't know what to do, so we just leave the room. And she was like, you have to understand, we grew up on social media, and when that kind of thing happens on social media, we just leave the channel. And that's what we've come to do in real life too, because there's really no way to cool the conversation a little bit, or we don't know how to. And that's really stuck with me, because we really ought to have more spaces and opportunities for being able to calibrate it, you know, a little bit more finely than social media allows, or, you know, a lot of what has gone on campus over the last year has allowed.
Which leads to an interesting kind of sampling. Those people who stay, right, are going to have more extreme opinions. And then what we see are the extreme opinions, and we don't see the people who decided to leave that conversation because it was simply too hot. Can I push back a little bit on it? I get that idea. And I this relates to something I've experienced as, you know, the associate DEI dean. I often find myself saying to my colleagues that even if MIT is a city on a hill, and everything's okay at MIT, people don't have the same experience getting here. And so even if it's not relevant, quote, here now, it's relevant for people who come to our community. And so that's why we need to talk about it and continue to talk about it.
Can I just crystallize a point? If I understand correctly, you know, given that the last year, and Ray already mentioned institutional neutrality, there's sort of a vision of the university. And it's a little bit like the vision that Ray started to sketch, I think, in particular. When Ray and I first got together, University of Chicago, and the idea of it is like the primary identity kind of put aside, and we have this vision of the university as sort of minds or something like that, that show up, and we're going to refine our minds and our ability to and our tools for understanding the world. And, you know, there's something about that vision that's very compelling and needs to be retained, but it's also not realistic and also not really fulfilling what universities can and should be. In the sense that we aren't a larger society, people come from just different backgrounds, right, that are relevant and that are often not representative on university campuses. It's a very reasonable thing an important thing for universities to be engaged in trying to understand and incorporate, getting people to be able to contribute to the life of the mind and the skills that we're developing here.
We owe it to our students
to
equip them in such a way that they don't feel compelled to leave that conversation. That they begin to understand, no. You have an obligation to this room. You have something to add. You have something to contribute, although it's going to be a little uncomfortable.
What I hear from Lily, tell me if it's right. You know, it's healthy for people to be able to withdraw.
Exactly.
Part of the time also. You were saying, Lily, if I understood correctly, is having the agency.
Yes.
Right?
Yeah.
The ability
to calibrate, you know, quite finely rather than this kind of, you have to be in it or you're not in it. And I think that's really you know, we don't have a lot of spaces and opportunities that allow us to calibrate more finely. So, and the reason that's important is because if you know you have that ability, then you might be willing to go a little bit further, go a little bit deeper, take a little bit more of a risk, knowing that you can also pull back if you need to. But instead, what I see a lot of members of our community doing is that they're either in it or they're not in it. And that it's very, you know, on or off.
And that's very interesting about the social media component to it, right? When you're on social media and you are using your name, you are in it. It's an either or kind of proposition, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know what to do with it, but I love the image of how choice was being taken away. I think that's a very powerful image to think through and play with in our heads, right?
I wanted to transition back to, you know, the questions of, you know, different identity, different groups. So the one thing we've done so far in this discussion just now, we're sort of, you know, haven't made any distinctions around respect to different kinds of identities, groups, different challenges that might arise. Yeah, and it depends on context. Thinking through the different kinds of identities we've talked about, the ways that identities become salient or not salient, and the questions or the challenges that lead to like, oh, do I understand what your issues are or not? Lead people to give offense or not give offense. That led to some personal reflections from you. And I'm curious where that took you.
You know, I think back to my last international trip before COVID. And I was in a taxi on my way to Logan. And the taxi driver was like, hey, your English is really good. And and I said, thank you. I was born in Oklahoma. And he said, well, your English is really very good.
So it was like anti-Southern bias. Is that what it was?
And you know,
either way, your English is really good, right?
So, you know, that just reminded me that there is a sense in which when people look at me, you know, I'm of Chinese heritage, that it's not always clear whether I'm American or not, or whether I was American born or not. I mean, I don't know that I take offense, which, you know, comes back to this concept that sociologists talk about as the perpetual outsider, or this axis, coming back to what the two of you had been talking about in terms of vertical or sort of hierarchies of identities. You know, there's the sort of color hierarchy, but then there's also this different kind of insider-outsider, which is American and foreign. And for whatever reason, East Asians are often seen on that American-foreign hierarchy on the foreign side of the axis. So I think that that's one thing that I think about a lot. I experience a lot. And that, I think, has been really interesting to try to reconcile with another way that Asians or East Asians are conceptualized, which is this model minority kind of concept. And what's really interesting is that the two are a little bit at odds with one another. That, you know, the perpetual outsider can't actually be a model in a way. And yet, you know, East Asians, Asians are conceptualized as the model minority. I mean, right. I think that, you know, if you're Chinese American and what you're grappling with is this, you know, conception of the perpetual outsider, that makes you think twice about assuming that somebody who looks like they might have a connection to what's going on in a country outside of the United States, it makes you think twice about assuming that they are affected or that they care. Maybe they would perceive your reaching out as assuming that their primary loyalties are to a country outside of the United States. But of course, if you know, haven't been struggling with assumptions that you might be a foreigner or foreign-born, that might not occur to you. So that's right. I mean, I think that makes things, you know, it's very complicated. It winds up being very tricky.
That's interesting. So that kind of speaks to why, it goes back to what Ray, you and I have been talking about in terms of lenses, right? Can I also ask, you know, are there circumstances you can imagine, Lily, where if you're Asian American, you might actually want people to reach out? The scenario I'm thinking of, maybe this is right. So let's say it's the beginning of COVID and there are rumors flying sort of attacking China. You know, so it's not explicit that has anything to do with Asian Americans, right? But I think everyone kind of understood. So in those circumstances, I think perhaps not unreasonable for people to think, oh, I reach out to my Asian American friend and I say, well, this is awful. And like, even though they're attacking China, they're sort of attacking you, right? Or potentially attacking you.
I mean,
right?
I think
variation on it, right? Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think that's a really interesting example because I could also imagine some incredibly well-intended friends and colleagues reaching out to say, like, you know, this is not an attack on you. And, you know, my reacting or my feeling like, well, of course it's nothing to do with me.
Right.
Why would you think?
Right. Right. And then they would feel terrible that they even read it. Right?
Exactly. Why would you have thought? Yeah, right. So those are the really difficult things to navigate, which is why, you know, I think I assume that everybody is finding this all really difficult to navigate. So that goes back to like, I'm not sure that there was an offense. And I'm going to assume that this is all just, you know, exploring things the way that we're doing on this podcast in real time. You know, all of these things I find to be completely understandable given where everybody has grown up, is coming from, you know, is trying to figure out. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's interesting. I mean, some of this made me also think about doing field research in sub-Saharan Africa and the different ways in which people that I'm working with, talking with in East Africa or West Africa are reacting to me. And it reminds me of, for example, when I first started doing field research in sub-Saharan Africa, I was working in very rural areas. And I remember realizing that people were referring to me as white. They were, you know, we were talking about, you know, the advisability of including a particular question on a survey that we wanted to run. And somebody was giving us feedback that wouldn't necessarily go over well because we were asking it as white people. And that sort of stopped me up short because I realized that in this context where, you know, people in rural areas probably haven't come across anybody you know, that looks ethnically Asian or ethnically Chinese. I'm being seen as white. But of course, in other situations, I'm thinking of a time when I was sitting down to meet some government officials in West Africa that we were potentially going to collaborate with. And they didn't know necessarily very much about my background. I think they knew I was from a university, but that didn't necessarily tell them much about my nationality or my personal background. And they were continuing a conversation that they had been having already when I walked into the room about an international aid agency they were working with. And the international aid agency was populated by people they were referring to as Westerners. And they were talking about how these Westerners are just so arrogant. They keep telling us what we should do and how we should measure things. And it became clear to me they did not realize that I was a quote Westerner. And so, you know, I sat down and I started asking them a little bit about the situation, just as small talk, really. And I think that based on what they told me, it kind of led me to agree that there was quite a bit of hubris being shown. And then we kind of got into the formal introductions and it became clear to them because then other members of my research team joined us and they were, you know, sort of more stereotypical Americans in the sense that they were white Americans. And it became clear to the officials that we were talking to that I was, you know, for all intents and purposes, the same as the rest of my research team. But there, I think it was interesting because I think it helped actually that before revealing myself as a Westerner, that I validated their reaction to the challenging conversation they were having with this international aid agency. And it probably meant more to them that I was validating their criticisms of Westerners in this challenging conversation they had been having because I myself was a Westerner. And so once they realized that I too am a Westerner and I am willing to criticize those who are also in my group in this particular situation, that perhaps gave me maybe more credibility, but it also maybe meant more in the sense that maybe they had also been wondering whether their criticisms were the result of like cultural misunderstandings or, you know, different, but to me, it sounded like actually the aid agency was just not being very thoughtful and that they were genuinely being arrogant.
Yeah. I think it also says, a good deal about you. I mean, we find ourselves in this kind of situation all the time. And it sounds like as you were describing the challenges of being a perpetual outsider, one can imagine just being offended all the time when that happens. But that doesn't appear to be your reaction. Your reaction is to seem to show some empathy for them.
Yeah, I mean, I think that I tend to assume that people are a function of the experiences and perspectives that they've had. And so unless they've had experiences that enable them to switch lenses, then it's in some ways unreasonable for me to expect them to see things the way I want them to see things. They just don't have access to the
lens. What's cool is you all of a sudden saw some opportunity to get them to be able to shift lenses a little bit.
Yeah. And so, you know, they then were like interacting with me and we went on to work together. That gave them a different lens with which to see me and to see the category of Westerners. And I think, you know, and that happens conversely for me all the time too. I'm always constantly learning new lenses or acquiring new lenses by interacting with people I had never interacted with and understanding how they're viewing a particular situation. So I do try to use these opportunities where it becomes clear that I may not be seeing something the same way as somebody else to try to figure out what the lenses are rather than to
figure out what lens they're using, right?
Well, I think this is an interesting moment where we're describing these interactions and the end result, Lily, is that you find yourself as an insider, right? In more than one group. Intentional, not intentional, I don't think that's important. It's just that by showing empathy and trying to see the world through more than one perspective, you're able to occupy this position that we've been talking about indirectly, but the fact that an outsider can be an insider also in more than one group. And that's an incredible position for a person to have, and it requires some empathy.
I mean, I think it is definitely the case that, you know, empathy is definitely important, but even before empathy, I think that curiosity is really important. So I think it's being able to start with curiosity about why are they having this conversation? Why do they think I'm a Westerner? What do they think about Westerners? And, you know, what's the basis of what their opinions about Westerners are? And so through that kind of interaction, you know, it's much easier to develop empathy, but it's because it starts with like a kind of open-ended curiosity.
I think this is potentially a nice pivot into your research.
So given how much Lily has already given us to reflect on, we thought this was a good place for us to pause and a really good opportunity to make a connection with our conversation with Lerna from the prior two episodes, do a little compare and contrast what the lessons we're taking away from it.
What we're learning from these two episodes as we think about them with Lerna. Now, Lerna shared with us her sense of freedom, the sense of freedom she experienced when she came to America. I think it's important to emphasize that Lerna came to New York City. And when she came to New York City, she suddenly realized that her Armenian identity was irrelevant.
Yeah, and she just kind of showed up and people saw her before she opened her mouth anyway, and people could hear her accent.
That's right.
She was just another white American.
That's right. And she described it as now being unmarked.
Right.
And that gave her an opportunity to be close enough to learn in ways that someone who's marked may not have that opportunity.
Right.
And now Lily's going to teach us another important but related lesson.
Yeah. So in the scenarios that she's sharing with us, right, I think two of them, right, in both cases, she's marked. She doesn't sort of escape being marked because she is in this white-dominated society. With its set of assumptions and stereotypes.
I just think it's a great example
Yeah.
And I think it illustrates two sides of the coin, is that learners talking about those situations where you're unmarked and there's an opportunity to learn and to be an ally. And Lily's talking about in that situation where you could potentially be an ally, but you're viewed with suspicion, and the benefits of taking action that, you know, really establishes your credibility as an ally, and it's costly signaling.
Yeah, and that leads right into what we'll be talking about in the second part of our discussion with her, where she really gives unique insights into what it means to be an ally. I learned a tremendous amount in that conversation, and I'm hoping people come back for part two, because
I think so. I think they will.
Learn a lot.
I'm Ray Reagans.
I'm Ezra Zuckerman-Sivan.
You've been listening to Outsider
Insider,
a podcast from MIT.
Special thanks for this amazing two-part episode to our dear colleague and friend, Lily Tsai.
Special thanks. And as always, we're grateful to our producer, Lucy McCormick. I'm sorry, Lucy, our producer, who got stuck on the side of a mountain trying to see a comet.
Chasing a comet.
Our producer is a comet chaser.
We won't tell her that you can't actually catch the comet. But
can't catch it.
But actually, Lucy can. Find out more about that at some point, hopefully.
With help from consulting producer Mei Mei.
And audio mixed by Hansdale Shi. And let's also not forget to thank our executive producer, Cato Sullivan.